We're back.
It's a crime in time first.
It is a first. So this is not a cocktail.
Nope.
It's not a wine or a beer.
Nope.
It's a shot.
It's a layered shot.
It's a layered shot.
It's a fancy layered shot.
So we're doing the B52 by popular demand.
I believe that I've had this before, but I don't recall exactly when.
I've never had it before.
I'm too old for shots. I'm nervous.
So if you don't know,
as I say every time,
a B52 is a 1/2 ounce Kahlua. And then on top of that, you layer a 1/2 ounce of Irish cream, or in this case, bourbon cream.
Yes, but can I say something?
Yeah.
So each one of these is a 1/2 ounce, correct?
Yes.
Each one of the three layers. What is the third layer? I'm sorry.
The third layer is Grand Marnier.
Each one of the three layers is 1/2 ounce. The Kahlua on the bottom is one size. It's like one depth. Then the cream in the middle is 3 times the depth of the Kahlua. And then the Grand Marnier floating on the top is about 1/2 the depth of the Kahlua.
Yeah,
however, all are the same amount of liquid.
I mean, granted.
In a cylinder glass.
Minus human error, but I did measure everything.
You did. I watched you.
And ours are both the same, and I measured each one separately. So it is what it is.
It is what it is. It's interesting how the layers came out, too, because my Kahlua to cream layer is crisp.
Yes, mine's
yours is
not
faded. Both the Grand Marnier to cream layers are muddled and floppy.
Yes, you can tell there's a difference, but it's not crisp.
Yes.
Anyway, so yeah, I've not had this shot before. I'm not that excited about it, but I did want to mention we are using a bourbon cream from Buffalo Trace instead of Irish cream because at my local store they did not have Bailey's, and I was like, either get the $6 like knockoff brand that who knows what it's even made of, or try this.
I have salted caramel Bailey's, but we did not think that would taste very good with the citrus Grand Marnier.
No, that sounds disgusting.
So I wonder, is the bourbon cream a higher alcohol density?
No, it was the same.
Oh, okay. Then I'm fine with it.
Yeah, it was exactly. I'm pretty sure it's Irish cream, but it's not Irish, so.
Right.
It's Kentucky.
Kentucky's good.
All right.
They have cows.
Are we trying this?
Do we have to?
Okay.
All right. Ready? I'm doing it.
Cheers.
Cheers.
I couldn't do it.
I didn't taste it. I just shot it. So it's Bernie. That is the sound of the follow-up beverage.
The bourbon cream's really good.
It is. I want to have a coffee because I'm very tired with that in it.
I'm still drinking it. Now I'm on Kahlua.
So I had a B-52. You had the deconstructed parts of a B-52, which will figure into my story.
I tried. I just can't. It's too much for me.
Oh, that's funny. I do not believe in as many years as we have known each other that we have ever done shots together. I know we've drank a crap ton of beer together. And wine.
I can't recall an instance.
I do not think we've ever done shots together.
Interesting.
That's funny.
So B-52.
B-52. I did not give...
Is it about the history of the band, the B-52s?
I mentioned them. Okay, let me get my sources out because I forgot last time and we'll have to add them later. And then I will talk about what we're doing. So I got all of this from aviationoiloutlet.com.
Sounds fascinating.
FAS.org. I will talk about that in a moment. Wikipedia, obvi. Because I'm lazy. Blogmuseumofflight.org, MansfieldDrewsJournal.com, BoldMethod.com, NationalInterest.org, FAS. Oh, I mentioned that already.
Yeah.
I was very tired when I wrote these notes.
Yes.
And LATimes.com. 30 seconds ago, I said I was going to talk about something.
FAS? That something like that?
Flat, don't remember.
Cool. Okay. You'll think of it.
So yeah, I'll think of it. So those are my sources. And the reason I gave my sources is because this topic was a lot of technical blah, blah, blah. And given that we have a significant number, we say this all the time, a significant number of male listeners that are about our age, I figured they might want to look it up, but I'm not a war historian. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, much. I like the story behind the story. Like, I don't need to know, like, all the little intricacies.
Right.
Like, there's some of that in my story that I'm like, oh, I should probably be, like, prepared to answer what this thing is. But then I'm like, I don't care what the thing is.
Yes. I want to know the stories behind. I should have been an anthropologist instead of a historian because I care more about the people and what they did on a daily basis than the specifications of this thing or the statistics of this battle.
Yeah, same.
If you want to know that, check out my sources because it gives you all of that. So anyway, I'm gonna dive on in. So typically when people our age, I had to write it out exactly as I'm gonna say it because I was really dying.
Jokes are built in from what I heard from child number one.
Okay, here's the thing. Child number two is a gymnast, and we've gone on weekend number two of back-to-back gym meets, and the last one was our home gym meet, and so I worked for 27 and a half hours at the gym meet, and then this morning I got up and wrote this. I'm tired. Anyway, mommies will understand. So typically when people our age hear the term B-52, we think of Love Shack or Rock Lobster. As you previously mentioned.
I'm already singing it in my head.
I know. Me too. It's been stuck in my head for 3 days. But the 70s and 80s band, the B-52s, was not named after the plane.
It was not. Interesting.
They were named after the hairstyle that was named after the plane.
I see. I see what they did there.
Yes. So the hairstyle that we know of as the Beehive was actually originally conceived as the B-52.
Wait, I have to interject because... So I recently just got a puppy, as you know.
I know, I can't wait to meet him.
Yeah, so now I have Big Dog and Little Dog too. So when I named Big Dog, his name is Rebel. I named him after Rebel Wilson because I like the name. We were going through names and I was like, oh, that would be cute for a dog. Then we got the dog and I named him that. So when...
And he's so naughty, he's a good dog.
Oh, he is the sweetest boy ever.
Yeah, he is not a rebel.
No, not at all. So when we got the new dog, he comes from a lineage, that quite a few of our friends have dogs from this lineage and they all have our names. And so we already had Rebel.
Nice.
And so now we're going through our names, trying to figure out what to name the little puppy.
Uh-huh.
And you know, like quite a few of the names we had picked out, like, or we were wondering about had already been used or like, you know, there's only a limited number of good dog names that start with an R.
Correct.
So we settled on Rogue.
Which is really cute.
It's really
cute. With Rebel.
Yeah. And so I'm like a Rogue and Rebel. That's kind of cute.
You have Regal and Rebel and Rogue.
So.
Isn't that a song?
I don't know. But anyway, people at work or like people I've mentioned it to are like, oh, Star Wars. And I'm like.
Oh.
Because I guess those are.
As in Rogue One.
Yeah. And like the Rebel.
Oh, the Rebel fleet.
Yeah. They're instantly always like Star Wars. And so I just started telling people, I'm like, no, I named Rebel after Rebel Wilson and I named Rogue after the Nissan. But I didn't.
I see. Okay. When I first heard Rebel and Rogue, because I have heard of dogs before. I've not met him yet.
He's still.
I say sternly and look at her like I want to see the baby.
He doesn't have all his puppy shots yet.
I know.
So I can't take him to dog houses.
I know. But I want to see him.
He's adorable.
Anyway, when I hear Regal and Rogue, Rebel and Rogue, I think of like that movie with Mel Gibson and the Western, and Reba McEntire was in it.
I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, I don't have no idea. Maverick is what it was called, I think.
Oh, okay.
But I think of the, to me, there's a, correct me if I'm wrong, people, email us, crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Something Rebels and Rogues? Isn't that a song line?
Don't know.
I think it is. I'm not sure. My dogs, the first one, Little Dog, is named because he's a white poodle and we got him at Halloween, so he's Casper.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Dog was because I wanted child number three and I wanted to name it Henry after my grandfather and call him Hank.
Yes. And he is your child number three.
He is my child number three. And so Big Dog is an English bulldog, and he is, he's not technically a Hank. He is, on his AKC papers, he is Henry Hugglemonster.
That's true. He's technically a Henry.
He's technically a Henry, but we call him Hank.
I'm going to start calling him Henry from now on.
Henry Hugglemonster. So child number two technically named him. Back to B-52 talk. So the like I said, the band was named after the hairstyle, and the hairstyle was named after the plane. So never heard of the B-52. Here's some of the jokes that I wrote in. Never heard of the B-52 hairstyle? Me either.
I was just about to ask, what is the B-52 hairstyle?
But apparently that is another name for the beehive. What we know is the beehive.
That's what I kept picturing, because the B-52 woman
has a beehive. Yeah. Yes. So that, the hairstyle was named after the B-52 plane because it resembles the nose cone.
Okay.
Margaret Vincey Hilth, from Elmhurst, Illinois, is regarded as the hairstyle's creator. The high-gravity-defying hairdo was first seen in the February 1960 issue of Modern Beauty Shop. Again, I always heard it called the beehive, but apparently it's also called the B-52 from the nose cone, from its resemblance to the nose cone of the B-52 Stratofortress, which is the workhorse artillery bomber of the U.S. military.
More on that later.
Yes. If you, bomb dropping, flight plane, protecting us from Cold War horribleness, the B-52 has done. And even modern day Saddam Hussein horribleness, other Iraqi war horribleness, B-52 has done it.
Oh yeah. We have an Air Force base not too far from this town, and B-52s have been seen flying over our town.
Oh yeah.
It's not super close, so it's not happening all the time. Right. But
you can tell when it is because it's massive.
Oh, it's huge.
So, in 1945, the Army Air Corps wanted to come up with a design for a strategic bomber to follow the B-36. They wanted it. They'd been using that in World War II. They needed something bigger. So they gave Boeing the specifications. Here's what they wanted. Wasn't very much. They just wanted something that could carry 10,000-pound bomb payload, could travel 5,000 miles, have a tactical operating altitude of 35,000 feet, and be able to cruise at a minimum of 450 miles per hour at its tactical altitude.
Make it so.
Yes, so not very much. The making so is kind of true. That's kind of what happens. So it's a lot. Boeing worked on this for a significant amount of time. In fact, I didn't write it down, but one of my sources that I found as I was researching this during the gym meet said that...
when you couldn't say your name correctly?
Yes, that gym meet. Thank you. See another podcast for the story on my mispronunciation of my own last name.
Smith.
I'm tired and sometimes drunk, but I'm not that drunk. Anyway, oh my gosh, you've made me, I've lost my train of thought so many times.
I'll stop.
No, I do it to you all the time, like constantly. The B-52 took so long to develop that there were so many significant technological changes over the amount of time that they were developing it that they kept improving it on paper, and they would improve it and make it better here. And it just took a very long time. It went through like 6 or 7 generations while they were still
like in pre-production.
In pre-production.
Oh
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but more on that as I go. So the Boeing is working on this, and they are trying to make it so they ended up having to use their own money to do the research to figure out how to make this plane go.
I wonder how that would work nowadays. I don't picture that.
I don't think it would. Yeah. They hadn't even officially gotten the contract yet. They don't get the contract for like 9 more years.
Oh gosh.
But they're still working on this. So, now, here, I'm going to read verbatim what I wrote. At this point in my research, there's a lot, I mean a lot, of technical mumbo-jumbo that I, as a non-airplane mechanic or military technical enthusiast, understood nor am interested in. If you are interested in this, write down my sources and read the many, many pages of numbers and $10 words for yourself.
Was that this morning?
Yes. So that is my PSA for the B-52 podcast. And you can go back and rewind those sources to look at all that yourself. So I did find some interesting stuff, however. And this I can kind of picture like the old movie. Like, it was in the 40s, not the 60s, but Mad Men. If you've seen Mad Men, this is what I picture. So I'm going to tell you the story. So it's Thursday, October 21st, 1948. Boeing engineers George S. Schuyler, Art Carlson, and Vaughn.
Art Carlson. I can picture Art him exactly.
Carlson. He's wearing a suit, a gray suit.
A gray suit, yeah.
A shirt and a black skinny tie.
Yes.
And he has a black foot or a white foot.
He's kind of a silver fox, but he's not quite that old yet.
He kind of is, just little bits right
just
here.
Just a little bit, yeah.
But then over the course of the production of the plane, the silver spreads.
He's like 43 or 44 at the time.
Can we just say he's hot?
He's hot. Art Carlson.
Art Carlson. And then Vaughn Bullmeister, Bullenmather was there too.
He's boring.
Vaughn has the chin that's underneath of his jaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know this. If you are related to Art,
we could have it completely
wrong.
Please
don't sue us.
We could have it completely wrong, but I don't think so.
We could. But anyway, picture in your head this scene. So they are very proud of this. They show their plans for a four-engine turboprop to Colonel Pete Warden. Can you picture Colonel Pete Warden?
Yeah, because he's, what's his face?
He's a hard ass. Colonel Pete Warden is a mean guy. He's a hard ass. So he is the
high
chief.
High and tight right there.
For sure. He is the chief bomber of development, and he didn't like it. He said, nope.
He probably just looked at it and he's like, I don't like it. I don't like it.
He did not want a turboprop. He wanted a turbo jet. So the engineers added Ed Wells to their team, who was the vice president of engineering from Boeing.
Ed Wells. Ed
They're
Wells.
Taking it serious. Ed Wells has, he's got the big glasses. The big black glasses. And the nice, he's, I think he's probably dyed.
Dark hair though.
Dark hair. Yes. And it's kind of high and tight-ish. He was in the military, but he's out now.
He spends a lot of time in the basement drawing plans and looking at plans.
I'm going to talk about that. Oh my goodness, I'm going to talk about that. I have to take a drink of my...
Not B-52.
Not B-52, because it's a shot and we're done. So, Ed Wells, add him to the team. They get a hotel room at the Hotel Von Cleve in Dayton, Ohio.
Sounds
for
nice.
Friday night. They work, or Thursday night, pardon me. They work all night long. All night long.
I imagine like a montage shot with like lots of like papers and like and throwing things
bed
away.
In the middle, and they're like sitting on it and going, humph.
Making coffee.
They've got coffee. The bellboy is coming in with room service. The entire place has like a layer of cigarette smoke hanging.
Oh, for sure.
I'm loving this.
Someone should make a movie of this.
We should totally make a movie of this. So they work all night long. The next day, Friday morning, they go to the colonel and they hand him a design.
Ed's tie is like a millimeter askew.
A little bit. But the colonel is perfect.
Colonel's always perfect.
Perfect. He's in his khakis.
And he has like not even like a wrinkle in his shirt.
In fact, he has like the, you know, the police officers that have the seam down the breast?
Yes.
He's got those. Perfect. And all his medals.
He's wearing them to work all night long.
Of course, no, he went home and went to sleep. They stayed up all
night.
Oh,
okay.
Colonel got some sleep. Colonel went home to his wife, who has not a B-52 hairdo, but a very nice 1940s hairdo.
They probably had a cocktail party.
They had a cocktail party. She wore the big, pretty dress.
The governor was there.
The 2.5 children begged to watch Andy Hardy. Oh, TV is not invented yet. They begged to listen to
Amos and Andy.
I was going to say Little Orphan Annie. Something on the radio.
Yeah, radio stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, they hand him the designs.
The Andrews sisters.
Yes, the Andrews sisters. He hands them back to them and says, top level engineers, vice frickin' president of engineering at Boeing. He hands it back to them and says, do better. Literally a quote.
And I guarantee you, I was like, better. I guarantee you those were the only two words he said.
Do better. So by Friday night, they've come up with a whole new plan. They are creating a new plane. This is whole new, we're going to scrap it all and start over. So they added some stuff to the landing gear, kind of getting into this technical stuff, that so that it can bicycle and it would be safer to land in a crosswind. It would be able to crab or roll with a sideways slip angle down the runway if it needed to.
Cool story.
Right. More on that in a minute. They hired a... So they go down to the local hobby store to grab supplies.
Remember, I'm thinking back to the Brady Bunch when they go to, like, I think... Doesn't, like, one of them build a model and they go to a hobby store looking for, like...
Glue,
I think.
I don't remember. No, they had to go to the hobby store to get glue to put back together
yes.
the base.
Yeah, okay.
When they threw the basketball in the house.
Mom always said, don't play ball in the house.
And then Dad came home with flowers for Mom and she put them in the vase.
Yes, they're at that hobby store.
There was a hobby store in my town that I grew up in called Pratt's Hobby Shop. And it was this hobby store. Every inch of that store was covered in shelves. And every inch of those shelves was covered in little bitty tiny square glass bottles of paint or brushes. Mm-hmm.
I remember there was one here, or, you know, in the town that is near here. Uh-huh. And my brother used to go to it because he would do, like, the model stuff. Uh-huh. Like, model planes or model, I don't think he did planes, but cars.
Yeah. Super fun. Hobby stores were amazing. Are they a thing of the past now with Amazon?
I'm pretty sure they're a thing of the past.
Sad.
Yeah.
So they go down to the hobby store, they get stuff, and Shire, S-C-H-A-I-R-E-R, sorry, I'm too tired to pronounce that, made a model. They hired a stenographer to rewrite the entire plan. Wells is a good artist, so he makes the drawings.
Oh.
Yes. And on Monday morning, they give the colonel a nice, neat, bound 33-page paper, complete with a 14-inch scale model.
Presentation matters.
Yes. And what they proposed would exceed all of the requested specifications.
So was the colonel pleased?
Yes. He was very happy.
Okay. He said two words. He said, make it.
Make it. It doesn't say what he said.
That's what I'm guessing he said.
It took a while to get things started. On Valentine's Day in 1951, Boeing was officially offered the contract to produce 13 B-52As and 17 detachable reconnaissance pods.
So were they also making the previous B-35s, B-47s, all that stuff too?
Probably. I would imagine because B.
Yeah.
B oh, has B. to stand for Boeing.
B yes. for Boeing.
Yeah.
We cracked the code.
We cracked the code. There was all of the numbers, like all of the planes, all of the numbers.
Yeah, I have, like, a lot of that in my story.
In your story, there's like 17 different B-52s as well.
Yeah,
all, they have letters after
letters them. After them. Yes.
So, in another source I read, I will come back here, but in another source, I want to talk more about the crabbing. Major Paul Grubbs had 6.5 years of flying. He was a pilot during the Vietnam era. He originally had been flying helicopters, and he got into flying B-52s. I'm not sure why. I read it. Don't remember. But anyway,
blonde. He's like got the wide shoulders, the knee waist.
There is a picture of him on the internet. He is exactly that. And he had the little foldable hat that you can fold flat, and they would put in their belt, and it would flop
over.
Oh,
yeah.
He had that on.
I got Paul Wells down.
Oh, he was he was very, very... No, it's Paul Grubbs.
Paul Grubbs, sorry.
He was very, very handsome. But so he ended up flying B-52s, and he had 1,800 hours. And this is the quote. This is some of the mumbo-jumbo, so I'm catering to our 40-something male listeners right now. When you're landing and there is a strong crosswind, you have to wing down with the opposite rudder, or you keep the wings level and crab into the wind and feed the rudder in to align the aircraft just before touchdown. Since the B-52's wingspan is longer than the fuselage, neither are conducive for long life. The B-52 has a system where you can crank the gear to 22 degrees off center so you can land the wings level in a crab. Once you slow down enough, you can crank the gear back to the original position and land. It looks bizarre.
I'm going to have to ask my dad, as a former naval aviator, although he did not fly B-52s, but if he knows that term crab.
Crab.
And if he can explain it to me.
It's got to be a thing. because they built this model so that it could do it. And this pilot is talking about doing it.
Yes.
So it had to have been an issue for the previous bee, the incarnations of the bees.
My dad did not fly the bees, but...
No. My dad was on a ship.
Mine too, but it was an aircraft carrier.
Ooh. Was he in the Navy or the Air Force?
Navy.
Oh, I didn't know you were in Navy. Was he still in the Navy when you were born?
No.
No.
No. He flew off.
Mine was still in the Navy, but he didn't fly at all. Mine didn't fly at all. Mine was a full-on CB in it. So, B-52s. Everything's perfect. They requested it. They got the thing, the contract. It's all good. Lots of testing was successful. There was also a lot of failures. Out of that initial order, only 3 out of the 13 were produced.
Oh, wow.
So only 3 B-52As ever came into existence, and the military returned them to Boeing to use in testing to improve the plane.
So they never were used for the purpose they were intended until the later iterations.
Correct. Yeah, the A's were never used. The 3 A's that were made were only used for testing. So they made 10 B-52Bs, and they were the first B-52s to actively enter service. At the ceremony to roll them out on March 18th, 1954, if you're counting, that's 9 years after they requested them. The Air Force Chief of Staff, General Nathan T. Twining, said the long-range rifle was the great weapon of its day. Today, this B-52 is the long rifle of the air age. So to train on the B-52B, you had to have 5 weeks of ground school and 4 weeks of flying. This got you between 35 and 50 hours in the air as a person who just spent 27.5 hours at a gym meet. That does not seem that long to me.
That's not very long.
No. I do not feel like I would have a handle on how to fly a plane after 35 hours.
I mean,
even if I were trained in it before.
Yeah, you're already an experienced pilot. But
yes.
Then you just basically spend like half a week.
Right.
Your part-time job to learn how to fly the new one.
I'm an experienced teacher. You put a new curriculum in front of me. I am not going to be an expert in that curriculum to the point where I'm going to risk people's lives on it after 35 hours.
Yes, it's not a lot. It's not a lot of time.
Yes, they reduce it later.
Because apparently it was a lot of time.
Foreshadowing. So anyway, it had some problems.
That might explain some of the things I'm going to talk about later.
Oh, interesting. So it had some problems from the beginning. The ramps and the taxiways couldn't handle the weight, and they started to deteriorate. The fuel system would either leak or it was prone to icing.
That's not good.
No. The bombing and the control computers had bugs and would have problems. It was a split cockpit where they had the pilots on the top and the observer and navigator on the bottom. So this was a big problem because the temperature control was an issue. The guys on the top are getting sunlight because their windows are above them.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys on the bottom are then relying on the climate control system inside the plane to keep their bodies regulated. Well, the guys on the top are hot, so the guys on the bottom are freezing.
It's literally like every man and woman in an office ever.
Correct. If the guys on the bottom
are comfortable...
They should
have put women on the top, men on the bottom, it would have been fine.
Right. So if the guys on the bottom are comfortable, the guys on the top are hot. It's crazy. Yes. So women and men and the covers. Do you guys fight over covers? We fight over covers all the time.
No, because the dog does not allow me to have covers.
Well, ours is the opposite fight of what my husbands and wife fight over. I want the covers off of me and he wants them on. So we have the same problem with the thermostat because I want the bedroom like a refrigerator and then have covers on top of me and he wants the bedroom hot so that he can just sleep with the sheet.
I have pretty much like if you bisect your body in half from like, you know, top to bottom, I have covers on one side of me and none on the other all the time.
Well, that's because you let the 130-pound dog sleep in the bed. I told you when he was a puppy to not let him do anything that you didn't want him to do when he weighed 130 pounds.
He's only 100 pounds, but yes, he is now, he's a bed dog. He'll be a bed dog. Yeah.
We had a same breed as that, and we were very strict with him, and it was a good thing because he turned out to be a buck 75.
Yeah.
We called him the bear with the bear skin rug with the bear still in it, which is literally what he looks like. But anyway, so the dudes are very uncomfortable on the top and the bottom. Our same sexy man,
Art?
No, Paul Grubbs.
Oh, Paul.
The pilot.
Yes.
He said that he was very confused by the plane because they had these fabulous curtains that you could pull. They were shiny, and you could pull them in the cockpit to protect yourself from nuclear fallout.
Okay.
Some sort of big, heavy
curtain. That would confuse me also.
Okay, but they had these, but they didn't have a hot plate or a microwave or any way to cook food for the entire crew.
Ham and cheese sandwiches.
Pretty much. Or you could just hold it out and let the nukes, you know, the
there
nuclear
you go.
Power
yeah.
cook it. So, anyway, to demonstrate how the long-range plane could be used, they flew it around the world with, they used three B-52s. They ran from January 16th to 18th in 1957. They used KC-97s to refuel in mid-flight, and it only took them 45 hours and 19 minutes to go all the way around the globe.
That is amazing.
Yes. This is 1957.
Yes.
In 1958, in September, they took the B-52D by this point, and they had a speed record of 560.705 miles per hour. Later, they that very same day, they broke the record with another B-52D at 597.675 miles per hour. In 1960, they set another world record where they flew for 10,078.84 miles without refueling.
How many?
10,000.
Wow.
78.
That's really good gas mileage.
That is incredible gas mileage. And you will find out why they needed that good of a gas mileage later. In March of 1961, there was an accident with the B-52 carrying two nuclear weapons. It left Mather Air Force Base by Sacramento and crashed. So just a few miles out of Sacramento, they had an uncontrolled decompression.
Oh, I'm talking about that.
Oh, okay, then I'm not going to talk anymore. Mouth shut. Mouth shut. So there was that crash. There was also later a crash in the east somewhere.
I'll probably be talking about that too.
Okay. Oh, okay. Whoa, there's a lot of interesting stuff about this that I now don't want to say just in case you say it. The okay. Fireman?
Sidebar. Pause. So basically what we decided is that she's going to add her stuff to my...
This is the first time this has happened.
Yeah, we have some coinciding information. So
that's interesting.
When we get to it, we'll get to it in my story, and you can add to it with the information that you've uncovered.
I'm super excited. So the new plane was used a lot in the Vietnam conflict in 1965. The plane had some structural modifications to have a bigger, quote-unquote, belly to increase its bombing capacity. They wanted it to be used for what they called carpet bombings. Which you can extrapolate from that saying what it is. The outside payload was still 24,500 or 750-pound bombs. These are bombs that are strapped to the outside of the plane that are dropped off the outside without anything having to open.
Okay.
The inside payload was increased from 27 to 84 500-pound bombs, or from 27 to 42 750-pound bombs. Now, I do not understand why they can originally carry 27 of both size bombs, but with the new retrofit, they can carry 84 500-pound, but only 42 750-pound.
Maybe it's like a size, I mean, geometry
but,
thing?
But they could both carry, they could carry 27 of both previously,
yeah.
prior to the retrofit, so I don't know. But anyway, so after this retrofit, the plane got the nickname Buff.
Buff.
Buff. big, ugly, fat fucker. Or fella, if you were in mixed company. But yes, that was his nickname, the buff.
I'm going to use that as an insult to someone so they don't know.
You're a buff.
You're such a buff.
Big, ugly, ugly, fat fucker is kind of funny. Paul Grubbs, our hot pilot, describes it as hours of boredom followed by moments of sheer terror. He goes on to describe some of the carpet bombings. I am not going to get into it. I was taking a break from the gym meet and sitting at Applebee's drinking a beer while I was researching this, and it was incredibly disturbing to read.
Oh, I bet.
What yeah. he describes. I did not realize that they called it the rain because there were so many bombs in this plane, and the carpet bombing, the way it happened, the bombs were literally falling like rain. And then they went on to describe something else falling like rain. Research it yourself. I'm not going to talk about it. But the Creedence Clearwater Revival song, Who'll Stop the Rain, is about that rain. Literally never knew that before.
Did not
love
know
the
that.
Song. Done extensive research on Vietnam, Navy brat, Vietnam veteran's daughter, niece, blah, blah, blah. Had no idea. I was stunned that I had no idea.
I had no idea. I never
So then
that.
I went and read the lyrics, and it completely fits.
Interesting. I'm going to do that later.
Yes. So, interesting with that. The jamming frequency, do you remember when we talked about Hedy Lamarr?
Yeah.
And her stuff?
Yeah.
Jamming frequency that she developed was used on these planes to keep them from being bombed out of the sky.
Cool. Yeah. Go Hedy.
Go Hedy. So during Vietnam, the plane also had a gunner in the back. In 1972, Albert Moore was shot down a MiG-21 or Z-1. I was writing really fast, and I don't know what that says. That was the last recorded use of the gunner during the war that happened when we were in high school, the first Gulf War. They were actively recruiting guys to become gunners on the B-52s. And then they stopped using them in 1992. So, hey, let's train you. Get in here, do this. And then, oh, never mind.
That's kind of how things happen.
Yes. But backtracking a little bit time-wise, during the Cold War, the B-52 was a complete workhorse for the American military. From 1960, this is going to amaze you because it amazed me, from 1960 to 1968, the United States had a B-52 in the air at all times.
Okay.
With a nuclear payload.
Okay.
They flew a circle. From, like, it went around the United States, up into Greenland, down into as close as they could get to the Soviet Union, back around the southern part of the United States, and back up.
Okay.
Like a big circle.
Yeah.
And they were in the air all the time with the nuclear bombs. Which
Ready
is
to go.
Where, yes, which is where the crash that mm-hmm. we're not going to talk about happened. And then there was another crash on the East Coast that happened. During the crash on the East Coast, 5 out of the 6 stages to detonate the bombs happened.
Mm-hmm.
We were minutes away, mm-hmm. moments away. So during the 1989 Gulf War, that there was another hot pilot that I did not write down his name, that he was flying in. They called the runs that the B-52 went on Taco Bell runs.
Oh.
And they call them Taco Bell runs because of the popular ad, Run for the Border.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what they would do. They would fly over, drop their bombs, and then run back for the border as fast as they could. So they made the guns non-operational in 1992. During the first Gulf War, 40% of the weapons were dropped from B-52s. In 1991, with the fall of the Soviet Union, the START Treaty, S-T-A-R-T Treaty, made the United States holding that many B-52s illegal. So, against the treaty. So, they stripped a considerable number of them. They cut them into 5 pieces. They sold the metal. They took all of the parts that were usable from them, and then they sold the rest of the metal for 12 cents a pound.
Wow, they scrapped them.
Scrapped them. They kept... I really had a hard time figuring out how many and what we still have. At the moment, as of 2018, we have 60 nuclear-capable B-52s in total.
Okay.
From the whole everything. They say it's going to fly for 100 years because it's just a flat workhorse. The plane was used extensively in both Iraq wars that I mentioned, and they said it's going to run for 100 years. The current cost to fly the plane is $70,000 per hour.
Oh, gosh.
So I'm sure that's inexpensive because they kept talking about what a workhorse it was and how that's just, you know, so blah, blah, blah. It's so cheap. It's wonderful. Seems expensive to
Seems
me.
Like...
My Tahoe gets a little bit better gas mileage than that.
Yeah.
But, okay, I'm super excited to hear about your story now that I know that it intersects with mine.
So it's not a story so much as it is a compilation of stories.
Uh-huh.
So I'm talking about Broken Arrows.
Yes.
Broken Arrows.
Know that term.
Yeah. Broken Arrows are nuclear weapons that have been lost due to accidental launching, firing, detonating, theft, or loss of the weapon. So the U.S. admits to having 32 broken arrows worldwide, with 6 of the weapons having been lost and never recovered.
That's freaking insane.
I know it's not a crime, but we don't know what happened to these things.
We do not know what happened to those things.
We don't know what happened. I mean, some of them you can probably guess because they're like 16,000 feet underwater. Maybe they're still there, but...
Okay, but if they're 16,000 feet underwater, how unstable are they?
Yeah. So we're going to start with the 1950s.
Okay.
The first broken arrow occurred on February 14th. I wrote 1059. I'm going to guess it's 1959. When a U.S. B-36, predecessor to the B-52, was en route from an Air Force base near Fairbanks, Alaska to Fort Worth, Texas, it crashed in British Columbia. So prior to impact, it jettisoned a Mark IV nuclear bomb in the Pacific Ocean. The bomb was never found, and it contained a substantial amount of natural uranium plus 5,000 pounds of high explosives.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I cannot imagine that... I mean, we've just advanced so technologically from then as far as, like, materials mm-hmm. and material durability and welding or however they're, like, constructed.
Yes.
Scary. Scary.
So somewhere in the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, we're so very fragile.
Right. So the Air Force said on this that the bomb didn't contain enough plutonium core necessary for a nuclear detonation, but it's still considered the first broken arrow in U.S. history.
And it's still full of, what did you say, uranium?
Uranium, yeah.
Yeah.
And a little bit of plutonium, but not enough to cause, like, nuclear reaction.
Okay.
So then, in August of 1950 at Fairfield Sassoon Air Force Base, which is in Northern California,
uh-huh.
a B-29 bomber was carrying a Mark IV nuclear bomb. It experienced problems with 2 of its propellers, and it crashed while attempting an emergency landing. The plane caught fire, and in the fire, the bomb's high explosives detonated, and it killed 19 people.
Wow.
So, like your story mentioned, this was a propeller-based plane. It wasn't the B-52, it was B-29.
Which is probably why the colonel insisted that it be... jet-propelled, not propeller-propelled.
Although there is a story about that later.
Oh, okay.
So, again in 1950, on November 10th, about 300 miles northeast of Montreal, a B-50 aircraft jettisoned a Mark IV nuclear bomb over the St. Lawrence River. It detonated on impact, but the core was lacking a necessary component, and it didn't detonate. So, luckily, the explosion scattered... Even though it scattered almost 100 pounds of uranium... The airplane was able to land safely, and everybody was...
Why was it missing that component? Was that human error, or was that done purposely?
I don't know, because there's so many instances of this. Sometimes it was error, and sometimes it was, in another location on the plane.
Oh, that's flipping scary. I want to tell the story one time about Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting on a plane, knowing that there's a submarine coming for him. Have you heard of that?
I don't know.
Okay, we'll talk about it later.
So anyway.
Pin in that.
1956, March 10th, B-47 is carrying 3 crew and 2 nuclear cores from Tampa, Florida, and it was en route to Morocco. And it was necessary for the plane to refuel periodically during the trip. So it had its first aerial refueling, and that was successful. Uh-huh. And then when it came time for the second one, it never made contact with the fuel tanker. So it ended up being reported missing over the Mediterranean. They never disclosed what kind of weapons were on this plane, but B-47s typically had the Mark 15, which would have had a combined yield of 3.4 megatons.
Where did it disappear?
Over the Mediterranean.
Is that near the triangle?
No.
Okay. Not that I believe in any of that anywhere, yeah. But just, you know, yeah. Fun to speculate.
No trace of the plane or the two nuclear cores have ever been found.
That's insane.
Gone.
Because they have, like, things to look in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. I know. And that's
so, was it stolen?
Nobody knows. There's never been a trace.
Oh, my gosh, that's so creepy and scary. Yeah.
So, in July of 1956, a B-47 bomber was on a training exercise when it crashed into a nuclear weapons storage facility.
Oh, my gosh.
Near Suffolk, England.
Of all the places to crash.
I know. And so, the entire crew of the aircraft was killed, and the storage facility contained three Mark VI nuclear weapons. One of the detonators had been sheared off in the crash, but investigators said it was a miracle that the bomb did not explode.
Wow.
So as you were talking about all these like little specific technical things, uh-huh. I didn't even look up what a Mark IV, Mark VI, Mark 15, what all these things were, because it's a nuclear weapon.
It's a nuclear weapon. Yeah.
It's like saying a bullet.
It's a great big bomb.
Yeah.
But bullets I get. Bullets I care about.
Because you've seen them in your
Because hand. I've seen them in my hand. Yes. A nuclear weapon. I hope I never see one.
Yeah. So May 22nd, 1957, this poor
being. Is that the one on, no, it can't be. Okay, yeah, go ahead. No.
A plane was transporting a nuclear bomb to Kirtland Air Force Base when suddenly the bomb fell through the open bay doors and it crashed into a field near Albuquerque, New Mexico. The high explosives detonated and it created a 12-foot deep and 25-foot wide crater. Luckily, the nuclear capsule was found intact, and the only casualty was a cow who had been grazing near the crash site. Poor cow.
Oh, my gosh. I think I've heard of this. Did they, like, forget to do the straps, or they thought they were tightening them and they undid them?
Could be.
I remember hearing something about this, and it had to do with straps.
Yeah, it could be, but, yeah, it just fell right through.
God, that poor kid. Because it can't be more, you know, well, we don't know. But I imagine in my brain, mm-hmm. we were picturing all
like
these
guys. Like a 20-year-old.
I picture some little 22, 23-year-old. He just got he's like moving up in the military. Mm-hmm. He's feeling good about himself. He's flying this plane. And, oh, shit.
Yeah. Well, there is one that I'll talk about in a little bit where the person, like, they do mention the people and the error that took place.
Okay.
So July 20, I wrote 28M. So July 28th, 1957, a U.S. Air Force C-124 left Dover, Delaware. It was carrying three nuclear bombs. The plane experienced a loss of power, and the crew jettisoned two of the nuclear bombs into the Atlantic Ocean, and they've never been recovered. So apparently that's a thing you do because they're so heavy. Like
they'll just fall into the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, and I mean, but they jettison them when they are experiencing problems with the plane because they're so heavy that...
So then they might be okay.
They might be okay, yeah. Later in October of 1957, a plane carrying a nuclear bomb crashed on takeoff at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. The plane burned for 4 hours and the high explosives detonated. Luckily, the nuclear capsule and its carrying case were intact and only slightly damaged.
Okay, so how does this work? There's, like, nuclear material in the center, and then they put, like, explosives
around it? Yeah.
So, here's my question. There's a whole lot of these bombs that accidentally go off where all of the...
High explosives.
High explosive detonate, but the nuclear bomb itself doesn't detonate. So, what if we want it to detonate?
I mean, I feel like that's been tested.
Twice?
Yeah.
But it's been a whole lot more times where they have exploded the explosives around it, but inside didn't go off.
I know.
And that would be a big mistake. If you were trying to do that on purpose, that could be a very fatal mistake.
Oh, for sure. So, 1958, it was February 5th near Savannah, Georgia. While on a practice exercise, an F-86 fighter plane collided with a B-47 bomber.
Oh my gosh.
The bomber was carrying a 7,600-pound Mark 15 nuclear bomb. The F-86 crashed after the pilot ejected from the plane. The crew of the B-47 requested permission to jettison the bomb in order to reduce weight and prevent the bomb from exploding during an emergency landing. So the bomb was jettisoned over Wassa Sound off the shores of Tybee Island, and subsequent searches failed to locate the weapon. And it's still unknown, well, I'm sure somebody knows, but the people don't know, if the bomb had the plutonium trigger. If it did, the blast could have caused a fireball of 1.2 miles in radius and thermal radiation causing third-degree burns for 12 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So these ones that are put in the water close to land, what happens when the water corrodes that encasement system?
I guess we'll find out.
Are you talking about that later?
No.
Okay. Because I'm just thinking that could be, you know, talk about pollution.
Oh, here's, okay, this is the one I was mentioning earlier.
Okay.
So March 11, 1958, a U.S. Air Force B-47 took off from Savannah, Georgia en route to the U.K. The aircraft was carrying nuclear weapons in case a war with the Soviet Union broke out.
Uh-huh.
Captain Earl Kohler noticed that a fault light in the cockpit indicating the bomb harness locking pin had not engaged. So he sent Captain Bruce Kulka to the bomb bay to fix the problem. As Kulka reached around the bomb, he mistakenly grabbed the emergency release pin.
That's what I've heard of.
Okay. And the Mark VI bomb dropped into the bomb bay doors. And the bomb's weight forced the doors open, and the bomb dropped 15,000 feet into the ground. So
this poor kid is sitting there looking at the ground underneath of him and thinking,
yeah.
Oh, shit!
And it gets worse. So two sisters... Oh, 6-year-old Helen and 9-year-old Francis and their 9-year-old cousin Ella were playing 200 yards from their playhouse. The bomb struck the playhouse.
Oh, my God.
The high explosives detonated, and it created a crater 70 feet wide and 35 feet deep. Fortunately, the nuclear core had been stored elsewhere on the plane. All three children were hurt, as were their mother, father, and brother, and they sued the U.S. Air Force. They received $54,000. Which That's to me disgusting. Is not a lot. That's not even an hour of a B-52 flying.
That is not an hour of a B-52. Not That's a third. Yeah. Two-thirds. That's ridiculous. Most people, that's disgusting.
So I'm going to actually, I have more from the 50s, but they're not that exciting.
Is there the one that crashed off of the East Coast?
Yeah, that's in the
60s. Where everybody lived?
That's in the 60s.
Okay. I researched that, but I didn't write it in my story, so I'll talk about it.
I'm going to skip over to the 60s because they're actually, like, just better. The stories are all much more interesting.
Well, all of that took place during those years of 60. Was it Operation... I wrote down the names, but I can't remember them right now. Metalhead?
I didn't have that. But also the 60s, they're actually using the B-52, not the other previous generations.
Yeah. What was it called? Chrome Dome.
Oh.
Operation Chrome Dome.
Yeah, I didn't have that. So we'll start with January 24th, 1961. A B-52 was carrying 3 or 4 megaton nuclear bombs over Goldsboro, North Carolina, when it suffered a failure of its right wing.
Yeah.
The aircraft broke apart, not the airport, and the two nuclear weapons were released. On one of the bombs, 3 of the 4 arming mechanisms had activated.
Wow.
In 2013, a Freedom of Information Act request confirmed that only a single switch out of 4 had prevented the bomb from detonating. One of the recovery team members was quoted, quote, "Until my death, I will never forget hearing my sergeant say, 'Lieutenant, we have found the arm safe switch.' And I said, 'Great.' He said, 'Not great. It's on arm.'" Yeah.
Was that the one that the entire crew lived? I'm sorry, I'm totally stupid.
I can't remember now because there's been so many.
There was one that I researched where the whole crew lived because this guy fought fast and they took the families like 80 years later back to the crash site, and all of the like debris was still just scattered all over the ground.
I don't know because it doesn't say. I didn't see that.
Okay.
I don't know if it's this one or not. But the second bomb plunged into a muddy field and the tail was discovered 20 feet below ground. So the decision was made to keep the uranium and plutonium in place. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they bought this like 400...
They just buried it?
Well, no, they left it there. And they bought a 400-foot circular easement over the buried components. So they just basically
left it there.
Had either of the bombs gone off, everyone within an 8.5-mile radius would have been killed.
So somewhere in North Carolina,
there's a nuclear bomb.
Just in the ground.
In the ground. With the uranium and plutonium intact.
Wow.
Yeah.
Beyond wow. Life is so fragile. We are so fragile.
I know. It takes, like, nothing. So March 14th, 1961, a B-52 Stratofortress bomber carrying four nuclear weapons... Oh, I said nuclear. I'm an idiot. Nuclear weapons experienced problem with its cabin pressure. Temperatures climbed between 125 and 160 degrees. So the crew descended to 12,000 feet.
Because they're hot.
Yeah, they depressurized the plane, which cools it.
Right.
All four of the engines flamed out. The pilot had to put the plane into dive, and all of the crew members bailed out. The plane crashed into a barley field near Yuba City, California, and the nuclear weapons were released. Luckily, the multiple safety measures built into the weapons protected against nuclear explosion or release of any radioactive material. Unfortunately, a fireman was killed and several others were injured while rushing to the accident scene.
To get that. Yeah, that is what I had where we paused. That's what I was talking about.
I know. I'm like, I have that too.
I think the one in the woods where the family got to go to the site later, everybody lived and it was totally fine. I mean, it wasn't fine because there's a nuclear warhead somewhere, but the family, all of the soldiers went home to their family, and then later on the families of these soldiers were taken to the area where the crash happened, and they all got to meet each other, and they were like women saying, you know, your father is the reason I'm alive because your father's quick thinking saved my father and we went on to have a normal life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool. And I wish I would have written, but that was one of my tabs that didn't re-come back
up. Oh, no. Well, maybe someone can send the link if they know about it. This is my favorite one. Okay. So October 25th, 1962 at the Duluth Sector Direction Center in Minnesota, an intruder was shot while scaling a fence around the facility. This triggered a sabotage alarm, which then in turn triggered a warning at Volk Field in Wisconsin. Uh-huh. That alarm triggered a nuclear-armed F-106A interceptor aircraft to be sent to the source of the original alarm in Duluth. Because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the U.S. was at DEFCON 3, and there was no such thing as a practice drill. Everything was the real deal.
Yeah.
So when Duluth communicated that nothing was seriously wrong, the planes were only stopped by a car that had raced down the runway after them to stop them.
Oh, my gosh.
The intruder turned out to be a black bear.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
We almost went into World War III because a black bear...
Climbed over a fence. In Duluth, Minnesota.
Because that never happens in the middle of Minnesota.
I know.
Oh, that's hysterical. That was so freaking scary.
Yeah.
Well, it had to be in the 60s or 50s.
Oh, no, I was just, what time of year? It was October 25th.
Wow. Yeah.
So then, January 13th, 1964, a B-52 carrying two nuclear bombs suffered severe turbulence. The vertical stabilizer broke off. The crew had to bail out of the plane, and the plane ended up crashing near Savage Mountain near Barton, Maryland. The bombs were found relatively intact, and three crew members were killed as a result of the accident. Oh. So that was another near miss.
Wow.
December 8, 1964, at Bunker Hill Air Force Base in Indiana, several Strategic Air Command aircraft were taxiing down a runway. This is the one where I was saying that maybe the propellers were still a good idea.
Okay.
A jet blast from one aircraft caused the plane behind it to slide off the runway and catch fire. The five nuclear weapons aboard that plane also caught fire, and radioactive contamination was, like, leaked, but luckily it was limited just to that general area.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you are of our age and you had to, did you have to do nuclear war drills?
Yeah.
Like, today, as a teacher, I have to do with my children, sadly, active shooter drills. We did nuclear war drills.
Which are literally the same as the earthquake drills.
Oh, we got under the frickin' plywood and metal desks.
Yeah.
Because that's going to protect us.
If you live in California and you had to grow up doing earthquake drills. They were the same drill. They just changed the name of it.
Yes, you got underneath your desk. Which, getting underneath your desk for an earthquake drill is dumb, too.
I know.
Because that desk is not going to hold the ceiling up. That's crazy.
Just hope someone else's crumbles in before yours.
Right? I don't necessarily know that our active shooter drills are that useful either.
At least sounds like the school you're at actually does them now.
We do. We do. Well, we watched a whole thing, and there was there's going to be policy changing because of it, because right now it is duck and stay. And so they're changing.
Interesting, because at the university it's run, hide, and fight.
Yes. And that's the direction that we're trying to allow. We're trying to find out if we can allow to happen, because bureaucracy
moves quickly. Oh, no, that's right.
It doesn't. Yeah. So we're trying to figure that out. And where my children are supposed to hide is on an outside wall. And in a previous school district that I worked at, there was a shooting in the district, not my school, thank goodness. But one of the things was the children were shot through windows and through the plywood walls of the portable building. Mm-hmm. So I have this thing about
that shooting
inside wall.
That shooting wasn't a targeted school shooting attack either. That was
incidental. He was going for one kid.
Yeah.
Because it was his neighbor's kid.
Yeah.
But so I try to put mine on an inside wall, and my only inside wall is full of cabinets with shelves. And I almost want to open all the cabinet doors, like put them in the cabinets and then close doors.
Get in. Anyway, December 5th, 1965, an A-4 Skyhawk attack plane was carrying a 1 megaton thermonuclear weapon. The plane rolled off the deck of the USS Ticonderoga and fell into the Pacific Ocean.
Is it lost like the others?
The plane and its pilot, Douglas Webster, sank 16,000 feet underwater and were never seen again.
So he didn't make it out either.
No. And it wasn't even until 15 years later that the U.S. Navy finally admitted that the accident had taken place only 80 miles from Japan, which caused an uproar in Japan because they prohibit nuclear weapons from being brought into their territory.
I can kind of see that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then sometime in the mid-60s, unknown exactly when, in the Kara Sea, the Soviet nuclear-powered icebreaker named Lenin encountered problems with its nuclear reactors. Possibly it experienced a full meltdown, and it was forced to dump the reactors into the sea, and they've never been found.
Okay, are the Soviets as careful with this stuff as we were?
Much less.
Yes, and the fact that their government that did all of this doesn't even exist anymore?
Not troubling at all.
Holy
yeah.
Crapitosis.
So the most well-known broken arrow occurred on January 17th, 1966.
Which one is the John Travolta movie?
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Broken Arrow, the John Travolta movie?
I don't.
It's John Travolta and Nick Cage, I think.
I don't watch movies.
Oh my goodness. Okay, edit that out. Never mind.
You're mistaking me for someone that watches movies.
Never mind.
I read books.
I'm
okay. Just kidding.
I'm so sorry.
Just kidding. I watch TV.
Sorry. Start over.
The most well-known broken arrow occurred on January 17th, 1966, near Palomares, Spain. A U.S. B-52 was carrying 4 nuclear weapons, and it collided with a refueling tanker at 31,000 feet and crashed over the Mediterranean. So of the 4 Mark 28 type H-bombs, 3 were found on land near Palomares. The high explosives in 2 of the bombs had detonated and released plutonium contamination. And that was across a 0.77 square mile area. The 4th bomb was found intact after a 2.5 month long search. And during the cleanup effort, over 1,400 tons of soil were sent to a nuclear storage site. They said it was the most commonly known one, but I had not heard of that one before. So April 11th, 1968, a Soviet diesel-powered Golf class ballistic missile submarine sank 750 miles northwest of Oahu. Intelligence determined that the sub had been carrying 3 nuclear-armed ballistic missiles and several nuclear-tipped torpedoes. The CIA partnered with Howard Hughes to build a specially designed deep water salvage ship called the Glomar Explorer to recover the lost sub.
Huh.
They were only partially successful when the Glomar raised approximately half of the submarine.
Interesting. I've not necessarily done a lot of research on Howard Hughes, but I've read and listened to and a lot of things with his life, and I've never heard of that.
I know. I hadn't either. So also in the spring of 1968, the USS Scorpion, a nuclear attack submarine, although I wrote attach submarine, because I'm a good typist, mysteriously sank about 400 miles southwest of the Azores Island. All 99 crew members were killed, and also the Scorpion was carrying two nuclear tip weapons that yielded 250 kilotons.
Why do we have so many of these?
There's so many. I skipped almost all of the 50s, and there's only like a couple in the 70s, and then there's a few in the 80s and 90s, but I did want to mention this one. So this was September 19th, 1980, near Damascus, Arkansas. Crewmen were performing maintenance on a Titan II ICBM, and a crewman accidentally dropped a wrench into the silo, and it punctured the missile's fuel tank. The missile leaked fuel for over 8 hours before it exploded. The blast destroyed the entire compound. I can't talk anymore. But the nuclear warhead was recovered intact. Thank goodness.
Oh my gosh. So I was in the second grade doing nuclear war drills where I would get underneath my desk.
Yeah.
In 1980.
So some of the other ones that they talked about involved the Soviets and then the CIS, the Commonwealth of Independent States, if you remember that being a thing.
Was that the thing that Castro did?
No, that was like when the Soviet Union was kind of breaking up.
Oh, okay.
So the CIS included Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Moldova, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Ukraine, Uzbekistan. But anyway, they each had a few of these.
Right. Happen. I remember that was a massive thing when they were breaking up, is who gets the weapons, where do they go, who regulates who they can sell them to.
Uh-huh. And then I'll just end with the most recent one, which I also think is kind of interesting. So this happened on August 29, 2007 at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. Six cruise missiles were mistakenly loaded onto a B-52H bomber, and they were transported to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. The nuclear warheads were supposed to have been removed before transport, but they weren't.
Oh my gosh.
And once at Barksdale, the missiles remained mounted to the aircraft for 36 hours and were not protected by any of the various security precautions. And the missiles were never reported missing by Minot Air Force Base. So it's still happening.
So they were mistakenly put on the plane. Nobody knew that they were put on the
plane.
They
weren't disarmed, like, or whatever. The safety precautions didn't happen.
And they just left them sit there on the runway or whatever for 36 hours.
And this was just a dozen years ago.
Oh, this is in 07. Both children's yeah. existence.
Yes.
That is stinking scary.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's quite a few more. Some of them are kind of just boring, but...
How in the hell are we all still alive?
How are we still alive? Exactly right.
We should have blown each other up 150 times.
Oh, we should have we should not even be here, probably.
Because no, we're hiding underneath a school desk in 1980.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So now that we've completely scared everyone that listens to this podcast.
Mm-hmm. I mean, try the B-52 though. It's... kind of fun to make. You might be good at it. I'm not. I'm not an expert.
I'm a drunk.
Just a drunk. As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things topics. You want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay! If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is...
Patreon.com/CrimeAndTimeOTR.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.